The next morning, Solomon didn't have to make up a story of sickness to get rid of his houseguest. Baby Sarah truly was ill, and when Samson woke up, Dr. Morelli was already there.
She's just not thriving, Solomon. I'm so sorry, Rachel.
But what is it? What's wrong with her? What does she have that could make her so sick so fast?
She's been sick since she was born, Solomon. I'm afraid it's her heart.
But how? Why? Was it something she ate? Could someone have done this to our baby?
I'm sorry, Solomon. It's what we call a birth defect. Now, she may surprise us and grow out of it. Sometimes they do. But I thought you ought to be prepared.
Thank you for your honesty, Dr. Morelli.
Again, I'm so sorry, Solomon, for both you and Rachel. And I'm sorry to say it, but I think it's best if no one foreign is around the baby, at least for a few weeks. Sorry, sir, but it's best for the baby.
Samson, burly and barrel-chested, stood up. And for a moment, Solomon thought he was going to hurt Dr. Morelli.
I can take a hint, Doc.
He began to gather up his possessions and toss them into his saddlebags.
Thank you, sir. You can find excellent lodgings at Kendall's boarding house, just a half block down the street. Solomon, Rachel, don't despair. There's always hope. I'll be back to check on her later this afternoon, all right?
Goodbye, Dr. Morelli.
Solomon was vaguely aware of Morelli going down the steps, and then of Samson grudgingly following along after Morelli. And then Rachel was in his arms, and he forced himself back to reality.
There. We will ask for God's help. He will help us. He must.
And then he was hugging his Rachel and silently praying, and trying to tell himself that if they had not come west, their baby would have been all right, or at least there would have been a heart specialist who could help her. Rachel broke away from him and went to the baby's crib side. He watched as she leaned over the tiny child and scooped her up into her arms.
Don't listen to what that man said, Sarah. And don't you worry, not a tiny bit. You're going to grow up into a beautiful young lady, my precious angel, and love God, and drive all the boys wild.
Solomon sat down in the closest chair, and silently he began to pray. Ezra Welk sat on the west bank of the Colorado River trying to figure out whether he could safely ford it here or not. He had remembered there being a ferry here. Maybe it had been a few miles upstream or downstream. The only thing he knew for certain was that it sure as hell wasn't here now.
Well, crap. Try upstream first.
Reining his horse to the left, he began to backtrack the current. Almost a half hour later, just when he was about to give up, he came across it. Signs of a wagon train's crossing. It hadn't been that long ago, either. A few days or better, judging by the bent grasses on the shallow bank. Could be army, could be civilian, but he figured civilian. The wagon tracks were too sloppy for a military caravan, and it looked like they had some livestock with them. A few cattle and pigs, plus the usual horses and oxen. He couldn't tell if the water had gone up or down since their fording, although it looked as if it had been windy as hell. A dust storm, most like. He hated them almost as much as he hated Apache. And that was saying quite a bit. He crossed himself and started down the riverbank, heading directly for the Arizona Territory. The knock on the door startled Jason awake and clear out of his chair and onto the floor. Whoever was out there, he was glad they hadn't seen that. Rafe watched Jason try to get his spur free from one of his desk drawers.
Shut up, Rafe.
He finally did, and opened the door to find a well-dressed, middle-aged woman who was preparing to knock again.
Marsha Fury?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry about the delay. I fell asleep at my desk. My deputy's out of town at the moment. What can I do for you?
You can do quite a bit, actually.
She started to come into the office. Jason had hoped to keep her where she was. He didn't much like the idea of advertising Rafe's presence, but he had no choice but to move out of her way. Fortunately, she went straight to his desk and sat down in the chair opposite his, entirely ignoring the cell area. He followed suit by going to his desk, upending his chair, and sitting down.
I'm Marshal Jason Fury. The town's named after my father, not me. And you're with the wagon train, right?
Your father isn't Jedediah Fury, is he?
Well, yes'm. Or at least he was. He died while we were faring the main part of the town here, out from Kansas City. The folks, I mean.
Oh, I'm so sorry to learn of this. I knew your father. He ran the wagon train that Linus and I... he was my husband. Took passage with back in 49. He got us to the California gold fields in fine shape. We spoke of him often.
And now you've lost your husband?
Yes, I have. And I'm sorry. I'm Judith Strong, and I'm looking to settle in Fury.
Well, we'd be glad to have you, Mrs. Strong, and welcome to the Fury family. We're a little rough around the edges, but we try.
Oh, it sounds like I'll fit right in. I've got a few rough edges myself. A woman doesn't spend over a decade moving from mining camp to mining camp without developing something of an attitude.
I imagine so.
To get right down to brass tacks, Marshal Fury, I'm a dressmaker and a milliner, and I intend to find a place here in your town to set up shop. I've been looking over properties for the last couple of days, and I believe I've found one that will suit me, if the price is right, that is. And what I need to know from you is, who owns it?
Which building are we talking about, Mrs. Strong?
Judith pointed out the window.
Right there. The one next to the newspaper office, or print shop, or whatever it is. And please, call me Judith.
And I'm Jason. I'm fairly certain that Salmon Kendall owns that property. Salmon's our mayor, and he has a newspaper office in the boarding house, too. He's the man you should talk to.
Judith rose to her feet.
Well, thank you, Jason. You've saved me a lot of trouble.
Jason stood as well and walked her to the door.
No trouble at all, Judith. That's why we're here. Any more questions, you just come see me.
Thank you, Jason. I'll do that.
Jason stood there watching as she crossed the street and entered the newspaper office.
Hope Salmon sells her the place. He can use the money. Hell, we all could.
He turned back toward his desk.
Seemed like a nice lady.
Well, you know, you got a real knack for spooking the bejesus out of people.
Why, thank you very kindly. You got coffee?
Jason nodded toward the potbelly stove.
Might still be some left from last night.
Rafe managed to find half a cup still left.
Ugh, just the way I don't like it. Too strong, too cold.
Jason started to open his mouth.
I know, beggars can't be choosers. Crap, what time is it anyway?
Jason pointed toward the clock, which read 7:30.
Ah, goddamn mother...
It was Ward, and he wasn't alone. Wash Keogh was with him, and they both looked worn to the bone.
Hey, don't worry, Wash. They'll be fed and put up just fine.
Talking about the livery?
Ward nodded.
Yeah, don't give your mare a second thought, Wash. They know what they're doing. I let them see to my Cleo all the time. And this is undoubtedly the reason Ward rode out there to fetch you. Wash Keogh, meet Rafe Lynch.
Rafe took a step forward and held out his hand. Wash looked leery, but he moved forward too, took it, and gave it a shake.
Can't say as how I'm pleased to meet you, Rafe. I don't know yet.
That's understandable, Wash. I'm real pleased to meet you, though.
Y'all? Why come?
Are you kidding? Why, you're famous. I've been hearing about Wash Keogh this and Wash Keogh that since I was a kid over in California.
California, you say?
Yes, sir. I don't know how much of it was the truth once it got to us, but even if half of it was right, you're what you call a living legend.
Imagine that.
Jason figured that Rafe was just shining on Wash, but it was sure winning Wash over. Even Ward, leaning against the wall, looked a tad awestruck. It was as if he were seeing Wash in a whole new light.
Imagine that. All the way to California. Jason, I'm famouser than I thunk. And wait till you see. I found it afore the dust storm kicked up. Ain't she a beaut?
He dug down into his pocket and held up the rock.
What? Oh, my God.
Damn.
The three men stood there for a few moments, not knowing what to say.
Is that real, or did you have that painted up to fool us?
Ow!
Jason punched him in the arm.
Nope. Found her about 30 feet from where I was digging. Almost took me a piss on it, as a matter of fact. And I spent the next couple days trying to figure out where the hell she come from. Hoo-hoo! Ain't she a beaut?
Well, that she most certainly is, Wash. Can I hold it?
Jason tentatively held out his hand. Carefully, Wash put the turkey egg of a nugget into Jason's hands. The gold was surprisingly heavy, but felt cool, very cool to the touch. A few thin veins of milky quartz ran through it, but it was primarily solid gold. Anyway, so far as he could tell, he didn't know how long he stood there, transfixed by it.
Jason.
Reluctantly, he handed it back.
Man, that's really something.
Ward held out his hand next, and like Jason, seemed mesmerized by the huge nugget.
May I?
Rafe took it from Ward and turned it over in his hands.
Good Lord. This is one more thing to add to your legend, Wash. And something for Jason and Ward to tell their grandkids about. Just that they touched it.
He handed it back to Wash.
Seems to me a thing like that ought not to be melted down. Ought to be on display in a museum or something. What do you think, Jason?
Don't ask me. It ain't mine. Wash, you'd best get that thing up to the bank and get it put in the safe. And I mean now. There's people in town who wouldn't mind gutting you for it.
Everybody looked at Rafe.
Calm down, boys. He ain't wanted for robbery.
No, just murder.
Aren't you off the clock?
Ward looked at Jason as if Jason had lost all sense of reality.
I reckon.
Don't worry, Ward. I ain't lost my marbles. Why don't you walk Wash on up to the bank, then head on home and get some sleep. You look like you could use it. And tell Megan hello for me.
All right. See you tonight, buddy.
Ward made his exit with Wash Keough in tow, and Rafe turned toward Jason.
Don't suppose we know where Samson is, do we?
Not a clue. Figured I'd take a walk on over to the saloon first. I know he was in there last night. Well, I suspect that I know, but he hadn't left before we finished playing cards and went to bed.
Rafe stared out the window and pointed toward the hitching rail across the street, where a well-dressed, dark-haired man was just dismounting.
Who's that? Don't believe I've seen him before.
No idea. Might be a card shark looking for a game.
Jason grabbed his hat off the rack and settled it on his head.
Yeah, I'm going.
Riding slow and taking his time, Ezra Welk, long drive from his ride across the river, continued to follow the wagon train's trail. Except now, his keen tracker's eye had picked up a new rider, one who had more recently followed in the wagon's path.
Wherever these wagons were going is sure a popular place.
He thought long and hard about avoiding it. After all, he was still wanted in the territory for killing that blacksmith.
Jacobs. Served the bum right for shooing my horse off kilter like that. Cost me the horse.
Old Barry fell and busted his leg. Dang near busted Ezra's too. Not a day out of that piddling little town. And Ezra had to shoot him.
Maybe I should have held off on killing Jacobs. Maybe I should have had him carry all of Barry's tack and gear 4 days through the desert to the next town. And then shot him.
He'd never heard of a town being out this way. It might be nothing more than a stage stop. And stage stops didn't have sheriffs, but they almost always had whiskey. And sometimes they had women. Still smiling, Ezra kept on following the wagon's path. And the path that another rider had followed before him. West of Fury, riding at a slow jog and taking his time, Teddy Gunderson rode through the desert brush, following the track the wagon train's recent passage had provided. He had just ridden past the site of two fresh grave markers, travelers killed in that nasty dust storm, he figured, and by his reckoning, he was about a day's ride, more or less, from his destination, which was Fury. A little squirt of a town that had popped up in the Arizona Territory about 4, maybe 5 years ago. That pretty much encapsulated his knowledge of the town, and the only reason he knew that much was that he'd spent a lot of time pumping a drunk in a bar back in Los Angeles for information about a fellow named Rafe Lynch. 3 hours, 6 beers, and as many whiskeys later, he'd found out that little snippet about Fury, but more about Rafe Lynch. He'd already known the man had 12,000, maybe more, on his head, and that was reason enough to pique his interest and to make him play nice with the old sot who'd given him the information he needed. He'd even found out about the wagon train, which had left a day earlier.
Plying drunks might turn out to be just one more cost of doing business.
Gunderson was a bounty hunter, new to the trade, having captured and turned in only 2 men. But they had each paid him well enough that he wanted to keep on doing it.
Hell,
if I can get Rafe Lynch, I'll be set for life.
He couldn't take him in town. He knew that much. As badly as California wanted Lynch, he was as clean as a whistle in Arizona. Killing him on this side of the river would make him a murderer and put a price on his head. He sure didn't want that. He figured to wait until Rafe was out of sight of the city and then shoot him, or at least kidnap him and take him to the other side of the Colorado River and then shoot him. Teddy was a clever man. At the moment, he had no idea how he'd get Lynch alone outside the walls of Fury, but he was convinced that he'd think of something. He always did. Jason walked out of the saloon where the barkeep had told him that Sampson Davis had finally given up on Lynch at about 2 a.m. and gone on home. He was staying at the boarding house, which Jason was relieved to hear, and the men at the saloon hadn't seen hide nor hair of him since last night.
Hope Saul's doing all right. Wonder what he did to get rid of Sampson Davis. Hope there wasn't any bloodshed.
When he arrived at the mercantile, the youngest Cohen boy was sitting out front, back in the shadow of the building, huddled on a bench with his knees drawn up and his head buried in his arms.
Jacob?
Jason didn't know if he'd gotten the name right. The boys ran together in his mind, but the kid looked up at him with tear-stained eyes.
What's the trouble, son?
The doctor was here this morning. They thought I was asleep, but I heard him talking, and he says my baby sister's gonna probably die.
Jason sat down next to him, pulling him close. The boy immediately threw his arms around Jason and hugged him for dear life, leaving Jason uncertain about what to do next.
Jacob, the doctor didn't say for sure, did he?
No, but he said she might.
Jason felt the boy's hot tears soaking through his shirt. He dipped his head to the boy's ear.
You know, I think that Dr. Morelli said that just in case. Well, he told me that in a lot of cases, just the passing of time can heal a body. You know, like, you remember the time I got shot?
Against his side, the boy nodded.
Well, I didn't die, did I? After enough time passed, I was up and around and feeling a lot better.
He gave the boy a little hug, then extricated himself and stood up.
I'm gonna go in to see your father now. He around?
He's here. Marshall, please don't tell him I was listening.
Your secret's safe with me.
Jason put a hand on the boy's head. He still wasn't sure which one he was, and ruffled his hair before he went inside. He stood there a few minutes, waiting for someone to respond. Now wasn't exactly the time to holler for help, but a few seconds before he turned to go back outside, Solomon poked his head around the staircase corner.
What can I do for... Jason... How kind of you to stop by.
Solomon, I just stopped by to ask you how the devil you managed to get rid of Sampson Davis.
He'd thought it was a safe question to ask. When Jason took a step toward Solomon, he held out his hands, as if warding Jason off, and stepped behind a counter, putting it between them. Then he turned his back, got himself under control, and sheepishly turned back to face Jason, who reached across the counter to touch Solomon's arm.
Good Lord, Saul, is it that bad?
It's little Sarah. She's dying.
Surely not.
But slowly, Solomon repeated what Morelli had told them this morning. It didn't sound good at all.
Solomon, now I believe that your baby's going to be fine. I believe that she's going to be better than fine. Any child who had the nerve to be born during and live through that storm is strong right down to her heart and soul. I believe that with all my heart.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for listening and for being a kind ear to talk to. Thank you for being my friend.
Jason stayed in the mercantile for a long time, and after he pushed Saul into the storeroom, even waited on a man who came in looking for nails and chicken wire. Hours later, Jason stood outside on the boardwalk, staring down the street toward the boarding house. It was past noon, he knew that much, because the sun threw his shadow in front of him as he began to walk east down Main Street.
I still don't know where to start with Sampson Davis.
Solomon had told him enough about the man in teary little dribs and drabs, that he felt he sort of had a handle on his character. Enough to open up a conversation, at any rate. Carrie Kendall was serving lunch when he entered, and a quick glance at the diners didn't show him Samson.
Ma'am?
Carrie Kendall turned around, setting down the gravy.
Ah! Why, Jason! How nice to see you! And to what do I owe this honor?
Jason grinned. He liked Salmon's wife. The former Carrie English and her daughter had been members of the wagon train. Salmon's first wife had been killed in the same Indian attack that claimed Jedediah Fury, and Salmon and Carrie had eventually been drawn together. The new family had since settled in admirably.
No honor, ma'am, unless it's mine. I was looking for Samson Davis.
Mr. Davis is still sleeping. I understand he got in quite late last night.
Well, don't disturb him, then. I can talk to him later.
Well, then, you're most welcome to stay to luncheon, you know.
She was a famous cook, and he was tempted.
Well, my sister packed me up a lunch, and if I don't rave about it in detail, she'll have my hide. Another time?
Of course. Any time at all. Shall I send Sammy over to your office when Mr. Davis rises?
Salmon Jr. was nearly old enough to take a wife, but she still insisted on calling him Sammy, as did his father.
I'd be right pleased, ma'am.
You know, you're getting so you talk like a Texas field hand. We're going to have to usher you back east to college one of these days.
Yes, thank you, ma'am.
He crossed the street and entered his office. It was empty, at first glance anyway. Rafe Lynch rolled over and sat up on his cot. Jason began rooting through his desk drawers for his lunch, which Jenny would have dropped off sometime during the early morning on her way to school.
I thought you'd be long gone by now.
Too tired. Went back to bed. Is that lunch?
Jason had finally found the sack in the bottom drawer on the left and hoisted it up on the desk.
Yeah, mine.
He peeked inside and saw two of everything. Two thick chicken and tomato sandwiches, two servings of potato salad, and on and on. He looked back at Rafe, now standing in the doorway of his cell and putting his hat on.
Well, take your hat back off, Rafe. Jenny seems to have put in two of everything in the whole blasted kitchen.
Rafe hurried over, dragging a spare chair behind him and tossing his hat on the rack.
What a gal.
Jason just shook his head and got up to start some fresh coffee brewing. Sammy Kendall came running across the street a couple of hours later.
Jason? Mr. Davis is up and demanded lunch, which, of course, my mother's already served, so Davis said he'd head up the street to grab a bite at the cafe. And if you want to see him, you'd best light a fire under it.
Rafe was long fed and gone to the saloon, and Jason had been sitting there writing up reports of the past week's activities. He was glad for the break, if a little nervous about talking to Davis. He put down the report on the latest MacDonald false Apache attack, which he'd been working on, stood up and lifted his hat off the rack.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks to your ma, too. You've done your civic duty for the month.
Marshall?
Yeah?
Could I follow along and just, you know, listen to what you say to him?
Why?
Just curious. About your profession, I mean.
Sam, I'm honored that you want to learn more about the law business, but this fellow is a pretty dangerous sort. Part of being a marshal is knowing when you have to say no. And this is one of those times. I'm sorry.
Okay, I guess.
I'll tell you all about it later.
Well, that's great. Thanks.
All right, get along back home with you.
Very quickly, he found himself alone again and walked through the front door, which Sammy had left open.
It's now or never.
He began to stride up the street to the cafe. Samson Davis had just ordered something he thought he could eat, the beef stew, although he was pretty sure the beef wasn't kosher. Right now, filling his stomach was more important. He'd been after Rafe Lynch for a long time, long enough that he could be patient now. At least he'd learned where Lynch was hanging out, the saloon at the end of the street. Hell, he hadn't even known it was there until he overheard two cowpokes talking about it. When you came into Fury, it looked like it was all cafes and boarding houses and general stores and the mercantile, with Abigail's being the only source of pleasure in the whole town. Down at the other end of town, though, was where all the important stuff happened, and where he'd learned his man, Rafe Lynch, was staying, usually. Nobody knew where he was last night, or if they knew, they wouldn't admit it.
Maybe I shouldn't have announced my reason for being in Fury in the first place.
A waiter brought him a plate of beef stew, complete with a side order of biscuits and honey. And he'd taken exactly three bites of it, and it was very good, when he looked up to see Marshal Jason Fury standing opposite him at the table. If this upstart of a lawman expected him to jump or be startled, he was going to be disappointed. Sampson calmly set down his fork.
How do you do, Marshal? Something I can help you with?
Yes, there is. Leave town.
Leave town? Hell, I just got here. Can't a man enjoy your little oasis here when he's not causing any trouble?
Well, that's just it, Sampson. You intend to cause trouble, and in a big way. You've already announced your purpose, and I will stop you no matter what it takes. You so much as harm a hair on Rafe Lynch's head, you'll face trial, and very possibly a noose. Got me?
Don't intend to muss his hair or none.
Sampson took another bite of his stew.
Don't take this warning lightly. Lynch isn't wanted in the Arizona Territory. Leave him alone, and leave town.
With that, the boy Marshal turned on his heel and exited the cafe.
Well, the kid has balls. Too bad he has to die right along with Rafe Lynch.
After what seemed an endless afternoon of switching his attention back and forth between the reports he was trying to write and looking out the window, checking for any signs of Sampson Davis, Jason was about to rip out his hair.
Did well with Sampson.
At least, he hadn't wet himself, which was what he felt like doing most of the time he was in the cafe. But he wasn't at all certain that Davis had taken his warning seriously. In fact, he was pretty sure it had fallen on deaf ears, and that Samson's new unspoken intent was to kill not only Rafe, but him too.
Not the most comforting thought. What?
It was Ward, and despite his refreshing day's sleep, he looked like they were going to be wiped out by Apache within the second.
Another one! We got us another one, and he's over to the saloon right now!
Jason got out of his chair.
Another what? What the hell are you talking about?
We got another one, I tell you. Wash Keogh just sent word. He's been down at the saloon all day, and he says that the man just come in asking about Rafe Lynch. Well, come on, Jason. We gotta get over there now.
All right, all right. If Wash has been at the saloon all day, he's likely to be seeing elephants riding duck-billed platypuses. We got another what, Ward?
Ward threw Jason an exasperated glance.
Gunfighter! Teddy Gunderson from over California way. He's a bounty hunter.
Says Wash.
Says Wash. Come on.
Ward led the way in. Jason spotted Wash first and made his way over to his table.
Mind sharing?
Wash nodded and Jason sat down, followed directly by his deputy.
So, what's going on, Wash?
I thought Ward was gonna tell you. Sammy get you the message, Ward?
Yeah. Guess the marshal wants to hear it all over again, firsthand.
That's enough, Ward. Tell me, Wash.
Well, you're too late anyways. He up and left about 15 minutes ago. He kept pumping Sam for information, and Sam wasn't giving none, so...
What do you gents want to drink?
A pretty girl in a low-cut red dress was leaning over the table.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Another Boilermaker, Ruby.
Sure thing, Wash.
You seen Rafe, Wash?
Nope. Not since he come in. Went straight to his room and ain't stuck his head out since. I've been watching his door.
Wash pointed to his eye and missed. Jason glanced up at the row of doors strategically placed along an open second floor hallway that was barricaded only by a wooden rail along its outside with a staircase at either end. It was usually used by the girls and their customers, but Sam occasionally let rooms out to special guests. Rafe, it seemed, qualified.
And what about this Teddy,
Gunderson.
Right. Any idea on his story, Wash?
Nope, but I can tell you what he looks like. 6 feet, maybe a tad over. Narrow bill, kind of lanky. Got kind of sandy-colored hair. Mustache, but no beard. Young. But then, everybody seems young to me these days.
His Boilermaker arrived, and he nodded to the waitress before he turned back to Jason.
Where the hell was I? Oh, yeah. Youngest. Good looking, I suppose. The gals in here were gaga over him anyway. And that's all I know.
With that, he picked up his shot glass, dropped the liquor ceremoniously into his beer mug, and chugged half of it down.
Wonder if he's staying up at the boarding house. Maybe he and Samson Davis will kill each other.
It sure beat the other alternatives, which were one of them killing him or vice versa. Neither one was very pleasant to think about. Father Micah Clayton was inside the town that afternoon, visiting families of the faith and taking confessions. He was amazed at the number of Catholics in Fury, as well as their long lists of sins to confess. It seemed that a priest had never visited there before, and so the lists of sins went back 5 or 6 years, sometimes longer. He was startled at their creativity, too. In fact, there were several occasions when he had felt the need to hide his face during confession, lest he break out in laughter. Of course, there were serious incidents, too. Enough Catholics and enough sins to make him believe that Fury wasn't just in need of the occasional ministering touch that would be provided by a traveling father or brother. No, they needed a church, to whose bells they could hearken, and where they could find a priest, day or night, to comfort and instruct them in time of need. He understood that there was competition in the form of the Reverend Milcher, who he understood was in trouble. It seemed that the Reverend, who several people had confided in him was not ordained but only a layman, was losing his flock, or maybe had already lost it. Fury needed a church, and God was sending him signs that he was to build it. Father Micah didn't know if the Lord would call on him to tend its flock forever or just until a new priest came, but he was to do the building of it. He didn't imagine he could pull off something grand like the Spanish had erected all over Mexico and the southwestern United States, but God didn't mind. All he needed was a building to shelter the faithful while they prayed and listened and took communion.
And donated. The church will cost money to build, and I have to live, don't I?
He was one to freely pass the plate when it came to donations, and Christ himself would have understood his dedication to the wine decanter. No, the good folks of Fury could support him while he lent them the spiritual grace and comfort they pined for. Now all he had to do was find a proper place to erect his church.
My church.
He liked the sound of that. And the second he realized what he was thinking, he rammed his fist against the adobe-coated post next to him.
Thou shalt have no other gods before me, Micah. Especially not thyself.
He scowled before he examined his bleeding knuckles. Then he went back to his Conestoga to say 5 Hail Marys and 3 Our Fathers, much as many of those whose confessions he'd heard today were doing, and petition the Lord to grant him humility. That afternoon, at about 4 o'clock, another rider was approaching Fury. He was a big man, tall and stocky, but not fat, with dark brown hair under his battered hat, a clean-shaven face, and a deputy U.S. Marshal's badge pinned on his worn leather vest. He rode a blue roan gelding, the same one that had hauled him over half the territory for the past few years, and which he wholeheartedly hoped would last another few. The horse's name was Boy, and the man was U.S. Deputy Marshal Abraham Todd, down from Prescott. He scouted the landscape ahead of him, which included not only the fortress-like town walls, but what looked to be a wagon train parked outside its southern perimeter. The wagons were calm, although there were people moving around, and the horses had been unhitched and placed in a corral closer to him, opposite the open doors of the wall. He gave a close look to the lead wagon and wondered if anyone he knew was leading it.
Probably not. These days, the West is somewhere a lot of people want to go. Lord only knows why.
He reached the gate and tipped his hat to 2 ladies walking back in from the wagons, both carrying bundles.
Ladies, where would I find the sheriff's office?
They looked at him oddly.
Just down the street, sir.
He twisted to see a comely woman standing outside in front of the schoolhouse. She pointed east, down the main street. She had dark hair, pulled back into a bun, and wore a deep blue dress, and he was taken with her right away.
Thank you, ma'am.
He nodded and moved Boy on down the street. He'd gone about a block's worth when he saw the sign.
They must have known I was coming.
The sign read, Marshal's Office. He reined the roan into the rail outside, dismounted, banged his hat on his leg a couple of times, and opened the door. Nobody was there, so he figured the marshal was off on rounds or something. He went back outside, leaned against the rail, and rolled himself a smoke. A few moments later, Jason and Ward exited the saloon with Wash Keogh propped between them. He had finally drunk himself into a stupor, and Ward had volunteered to put him up for the night if Jason would help carry. Ward didn't have to ask him twice. However, they were only a few steps outside the saloon when Ward stopped suddenly.
Who's that?
Where?
His eyes stopped on the tall man standing in front of his office, having a smoke next to a blue roan horse.
In front of the office?
The late afternoon sun glinted off something metal on the man's chest.
Is that our man from Prescott?
Where are we going?
Jason began to walk across the street, hauling Wash and Ward along with him. This thing he was dealing with could go off any second, he figured. At least he still knew where Rafe was holed up, but he was clueless as far as Teddy Gunderson's whereabouts. He just kept hoping that Samson Davis and Gunderson would cancel each other out. When they had crossed the street, dragging Wash between them, Jason went right up to the stranger and stuck out his hand.
Jason Fury, Marshal. Pleased to meet you.
The Marshal took his hand and gave it a shake.
Howdy, Fury. I'm Deputy U.S. Marshal Todd. Your letter sounded urgent.
Ward stuck out his right hand, which was the only one not holding up the drunken prospector.
And I'm Deputy Ward Wanamaker.
Marshal Todd took his hand and shook.
Things are worse than when I wrote you, boys.
Stick Wash in a cell for now, Jason?
Yeah, I don't think he's gonna mind, let alone remember.
Jason turned back to the deputy marshal and began listing the town's current woes. As he talked, Todd grew more and more serious.
I think I've got it. You got a town overpopulated with gunmen and a nutcase rancher who sees Apache behind every cactus, right?
Jason's jaw hung open. Todd had boiled it down to one sentence, more or less.
Basically, yeah.
Now don't he make it sound simple.
Always best to tackle the problem one step at a time, Deputy.
Todd leaned forward, putting his elbows on Jason's desk.
Now, first off, I gotta tell you that I know Rafe Lynch, and I like him. I'll get back to why in a second, but when you get right down to it, he ain't no danger. Second, I just heard of this Teddy Gunderson last week. Seems he's tracking bounties now, and it looks to me like he's got the idea he's hit the big time. Now he's gonna pick up Lynch's bounty. California's got about $13,000 on Lynch last I heard, dead or alive. Imagine Teddy's thinking of taking him back west, over the border, and shoot him. Teddy's too careful to do it any other way.
Deputy Marshal Todd's speech was having a soothing effect on Jason, who, of the three men, was by far the most in need of it. He was, after all, responsible for everything that happened in his town, and everything out of it, according to Matt McDonald. Matt had got his wish, after all. Jason had called in the U.S. Marshal's office. But Rafe was no threat, which relieved him greatly, and Gunderson wasn't likely to shoot up the town or anything else in Arizona.
Now, I don't know much about this Samson Davis character, save that he served 2 years in California for the accidental death of a man named Silvers in a dispute over a mining claim.
All I know is what Rafe told me, and I already told you, and that Davis scares the bejesus out of me.
You know, I think you fellas are holding up damn well, considering. Glad you contacted us, though. And please, call me Abe, boys.
All right, Abe. We'd like to keep things casual out here, too.
Ward poked a thumb over his shoulder at Wash, who was flopped out on a cot, arms and legs everywhere.
Like our prisoner here.
Marshal Todd, no, Abe, leaned out a little.
I'll be dog. That Wash Keogh, for real?
Amazed at the marshal's handle on the situation, Jason nodded.
He's some older than the last time I run into him, but I'd have known him anywhere. You two ever need a third man to back you up on short notice, call on Wash. Good at fighting Indians, too.
We know. Ward here just brought him in this morning.
For drinking?
No, to help with the gunfighters. But now we've got you. You got a place to stay yet?
Nope. I was going to get a recommendation from you.
Well, Wash is already set to camp on Ward's spare mattress, so I reckon you can come along home with me for tonight anyhow. Got a sister who's a whiz-bang cook.
I'll take you up on that. Sister, you folks ain't old Jedediah Fury's kids by any chance, are you?
That we are. The town's named for him.
Why is that?
Jason's pa was the wagon master on the train that left Kansas City 5 or 6 years back. Jason came along as Ramrod, and I was sort of a roustabout. Comanche got him when we was most of the way through Texas. Folks here was real attached to him. Real attached. So Jason took his place and brought us this far. And then we decided we didn't want to go no farther. And that's how it was.
Jason was relieved. Ward was getting better and better at getting him out of tricky situations. That was Ward's specialty. His father had relied on Ward for 1,000 little details, and after Jason took over the wagon train, he had too.
I'm awful sorry to hear about that. I'm awful sorry. I knew Jedediah for years, when he was ferrying folks back and forth from west to east and back again. He's quite a man, God rest him. I'm real sorry for you and your sister, Jason.
Thanks.
They set out for Jason's home. After the introductions were made and they ate a good dinner, Jason and Abe retired to the front porch for a smoke.
That was the finest spread I've seen for a long time. Lips smacking good.
She's turning into a fine cook, all right. Our mother was class A in the kitchen, too. Guess it runs in the family.
Yep. You come from a strong line, Jason. How old are you, anyway?
25.
It's awful young to have to run a whole town.
Well, tell me about it. I've been doing it since we got here. All I wanted to do was go back east to college, but they wouldn't have it.
Who? The citizens?
Yeah.
Was that after the first Apache attack?
How'd you know about that?
Word gets round, usually without much care for the details. But I heard stories about some little town where they held off Apache by making a moat out of fire.
That was us, all right. We still keep a supply of tar handy just in case. Get it regular, shipped out from those tar pits in California. The ones outside Los Angeles.
Your idea?
Yeah. You can still see some of the scorch marks out south of town, right along where the wagon trains parked. We filled the moat back in after a while, but the ground...
That was a damn fine idea, Jason.
Thanks. Desperate times call for desperate measures. Or words to that effect.
Jason swiveled toward the door. It was Jenny, carrying a tray. He stood up to help her because the tray looked heavy.
Thank you, Jason. Thought you gents might be thirsty, so I brought you some limeade.
Jason set the tray down on the small table they kept on the porch.
Limes? Where'd you get limes?
The wagon train, silly. I don't know where we'd be without the wagon trains that come through. They bring us all sorts of wonderful things.
Jenny handed a glass to Abe, then to Jason, then picked one up herself.
Mind if I join ya?
Not at all.
Abe motioned her toward the spare chair. Jason sat down after she did.
Right good, Miss Jenny, right good.
Thank you, Marshal Todd. Jason, will Rafe be all right? Don't you need to go get him or something?
He knows about Davis, and I sent a note up about Gunderson. If he's smart, he'll just stick to that room of his. And Sam said he'd take meals up. Don't worry, he's well looked after.
That's right, Miss Jenny. He stays in that room, he's dead safe.
That's what I'm worried about. The dead part, that is.
I'm sorry. I guess I put it the wrong way.
No, you didn't, Abe. Rafe is going to be fine. We just have to figure out how to get rid of Davis and Gunderson.
Well, Jason, can't you just throw them out of town? I mean, you're the marshal.
That's another thing I've been meaning to talk to you about. You ain't a marshal, you know. Technical-like, you're the sheriff of Fury. Technical speaking, that is.
Well, only the U.S. marshals can be marshals? This mean I don't have a job anymore?
Oh, don't be a fool. I'm going to bed. Miss Electa Morton wants me in early.
With that, Jenny took her glass of limeade and went into the house.
Just me, or is she getting snippy?
She ain't that bad. Who's Miss Electa Morton, anyhow?
She's our schoolmarm. Jenny's her assistant.
Interesting.
They sat there for a little while longer and finished off the rest of the pitcher. Then Jason led Abe into the house and down the back hall to the guest room. It wasn't much of a guest room, being only 8 feet by 10 and without a bureau, but there was a cot and a chamber pot, and nobody had complained yet about the marshal's hospitality.
Am I now supposed to take on the title of sheriff, repaint the sign, and remold the badge?
The next morning, as he sat behind his desk, Jason seriously pondered the question. Ward, who had gone on home after a quiet night, took a complaining Wash Keogh along with him. He'd decided not to chance the 10 minutes he'd miss watching the saloon by simply walking Wash back to his lodgings. And so Wash had spent the night snoozing as an unofficial prisoner. It looked to Jason as if they weren't going to get much help out of Wash if he was half as angry with Ward as he put on. Then again, you never could tell with him. Jason was a pretty fair hand at reading folks, and he could tell that Wash was withholding something or other from them, but he wasn't going to press him. Not right now, anyway. He had left the house before Abe was up, figuring that the man had spent a long day on a hot and dusty trail the day before and could probably use the extra sleep. But later today, when Abe came into the office, they were going to have a serious discussion about their plans for Davis and Gunderson. He slid a quick glance across the street, but saw nothing, as usual. A fact which should have comforted him, but which only filled him with additional dread. He knew they had to be dealt with, and the sooner the better. But he wasn't looking forward to it in the slightest. He had a feeling that whatever action they decided on, the reaction to it was going to end up messy. He worried about Ward, and he worried about Wash, and now Abe, too. And mostly worried about himself. Not whether he'd die, that being a distinct possibility, but whether he would acquit himself in a manner that would do honor to his father's name.
All right. And whether I'll be forever done with the chance to go to school back east, that's slipping further away every day.
Halfway through the morning, before Abe had checked in at the marshal's office, Teddy Gunderson was waiting in the alley next to the Milchers' church, practicing his fast draw.
That was pretty damn fast. And I ain't being cocky about that, neither.
A man in his profession had to be both fast and accurate if he wanted to survive. Teddy had a lot to survive for. That great big bounty on Lynch was going to be the end of his career as a gun, and the beginning of his career as Theodore Gunderson, San Francisco Brahmin. He had started to think about it yesterday, and at first it had been just in fun. But then he got to kind of liking the idea. He could picture himself groomed up slick in a silk suit, real fancy, smoking an expensive cigar in one of those big mansions at one of those big high-toned parties up on Knob Hill. He figured he had everything but the money. And that was just down the street at the saloon. He'd known that lousy bartender was lying to him. He'd figured all along that Lynch was upstairs, but he was too smart to go barging up there and banging on doors, especially with what looked like the town lawman sitting right there at one of the barroom tables. No, he'd decided to wait for Lynch to cross his path, and then he'd just wing him, put him a little bit out of commission. And then they'd ride back over the Colorado River to California. Teddy Gunderson had it all figured out, all right. A desert sparrow suddenly fluttered down from the roof, and he drew on it, too.
Damn fast.
If he had pulled the trigger this morning, he'd have killed 4 sparrows, 2 doves, 1 pack rat, 3 quails, and the ugliest dog he'd ever seen. It would have been a high body count. Inside the church, the Reverend Milcher saw the flutter of wings and glanced up at the movement. He glimpsed the man he would later learn was Teddy as he pulled his gun on the bird.
Who in creation is out there, pretending to shoot sparrows?
He walked closer to the window for a better look. Outside, Teddy holstered his sidearm once again. He was keenly attuned to the rustles and stirs which might be made by a potential target. A daring strike made by a finch, perhaps. Or maybe that really ugly dog would come by again. Deputy U.S. Marshal Abe Todd had left Jason's house and was walking up the street toward the Cohen's Mercantile. He was in a good mood, having been left to sleep in and having partaken of some of the best of Ginny's kitchen in unexpectedly large quantities. He was just turning the corner to walk down the main street when it happened, he later said. He saw a Catholic priest and a man carrying a doctor's bag as they were walking toward him. It was then that he saw the movement in the alley. He saw a man fitting Teddy Gunderson's description, saw him quick draw his rig and aim it toward the men.
Down, Father!
With remarkable speed, the priest threw out his arm and pushed Morelli to the ground. The man fell as suddenly and surely as the 2 living targets had thrown themselves on the ground, and Todd made his way across the street.
You fellas all right?
Who was it? Is he wounded?
The doctor picked up his bag and followed Marshal Todd into the alley.
Dunno. Hope he's dead.
Was he... Is he Catholic?
Don't think it matters much now, Father.
Todd finally holstered his gun. Even the doctor's ministrations weren't going to perform a miracle, and he doubted that the priest was going to cause Teddy to rise from the dead.
I'm afraid he's gone. Who in tarnation was he anyhow? Come to think of it, who are you?
Before Abe Todd could say, "The man who just saved your necks," Jason came running up the street toward them, his gun in his hand. He parted a gathering crowd of spectators.
What is it? What happened?
He noticed the body, sheltered by the bodies of the doc and Father Clayton. He turned toward Abe.
Is it Gunderson?
Yep. Don't know what the hell he was doing drawing down on these fellas. There wasn't a whole lot of time to ask him.
Reverend Milcher stepped out of the crowd.
Why, I don't believe that was his intention at all. I've been watching him for several minutes, and it looked to me as if he was only practicing with his firearm.
And you saw this from where, Reverend Milcher?
The Reverend walked forward, then pointed down the alley to a window roughly 10 feet beyond where Gunderson's body lay.
Well, so you couldn't see the street?
Well, I'm afraid not.
To Abe, the sheriff looked pretty damned relieved to have Gunderson off his plate. And he wondered why they were taking so long just standing around when they could be carting the body off and getting on down to the jail.
Doc, you want to help us haul him to the undertakers? Come on, Abe.
He stepped through the alley where he picked up an arm. Abe took the other one, and the two of them dragged Gunderson out into the street. Abigail Crimp had come out to see what had caused the commotion and stood in the street, arms folded, head shaking.
That's a true and certain shame, killing a pretty boy like that. Don't he look like one of them angels in an Italian painting?
He was drawn on Dr. Morelli and a member of the priesthood, Abigail.
He's pretty, though.
Abigail turned and walked back up toward her bar. Abe, Jason, and now Dr. Morelli walked in the opposite direction, bearing Teddy Gunderson's corpse between them.
Hell, and it ain't even close to noon yet.
Once they had Teddy at the undertaker's, Dr. Morelli set to work on him and discovered that Abe Todd's slug had taken him right through the heart. This explained the lack of blood flow to Jason.
So now we only got Davis to fret about.
Abe didn't even bother to turn around. He just stood by the window, amid stacks of chairs and tables and other things, the undertaker also being the town's furniture maker, and stared out into the street.
We need to get back over to the office. You'll wait for the undertaker, Doc?
That I will, but he'd best hurry. I need to get up to see Solomon and Rachel's baby.
How is she, anyway?
Not good, the last time I saw her.
Whole town's praying for her, Doc.
Let's hope it helps.
Jason and Abe crossed the street, went into the office, and took seats on either side of the desk, before they realized they had company. Rafe Lynch sat on a bunk in the first cell, his head hanging down.
Rafe?
Afraid so. Heard the shot and figured it might be a good idea to get my butt over here. Was I right?
You were.
Who's your friend?
Oh, I'm sorry. Rafe Lynch. Meet,
Abe Todd. Spiders and snakes, it has been a coon's age.
Abe stood up and met him in the middle of the floor, and they pounded each other's backs like long-lost friends. Jason found himself on his feet, too.
Well, hold your horses. What's going on?
Well, me and Abe here are old buddies.
Knowed him since he was in diapers.
Thanks for admitting how much older than me you are.
You better watch your step, you punk kid.
Rafe gave him a friendly punch in the arm.
I don't need this.
Jason was becoming more confused by the hour about where the line between good and evil lay. And he was beginning to think that Jenny was right. Maybe he should just go across the street to the boarding house and put a slug between Davis's eyes. It'd sure make things easier.
Maybe the citizens should vote in a new marshal, too. Like, for instance, Rafe. That'd be about their speed.
Grab a chair, Rafe. Let's all sit down and take a load off. All right, Jason?
Jason lowered himself back down without replying.
Jason, you look like somebody just stole your boat.
The analogy was lost on Jason, who'd never lived on the water in his life.
You two just boggle my mind, that's all. I mean, you just killed a man, Abe. And when we got him to the undertaker's, you didn't pay him a bit of attention. And then when we came across Rafe here, an outlaw of the First Order, you treat him like your long-lost kin.
Well, he probably wasn't much help at the undertaker's because he can't stand the sight of blood.
Dr. Morelli finally left the undertaker's and headed up the street to the mercantile, this time taking care to switch to the other side of the street before he came to the alley.
Once bitten, twice shy.
He stopped to take a long look into the mouth of it before he dared pass. He'd been fretting about Solomon and Rachel's baby all night, and all day yesterday, too. He'd gotten down his old textbooks and read everything he could on heart problems, and on the very young, but he still couldn't make heads or tails of it. He just knew that there was something wrong inside, something that made a whoosh when it should have made a solid thump. She was too thin and acted listless, and Rachel had told him that the baby hardly cried at all. All of which was the wrong kind of news to hear about a newborn. He didn't like it at all. If this baby died, he didn't know that Solomon would retain his sanity. Rachel was the stronger of the two. She would suffer, but she'd be all right. But Morelli didn't think Solomon could stand to bury another child. He had changed his name mere months after the last boy died. Morelli shook his head and opened the mercantile's door. Solomon was there to greet him.
Morning, Solomon. Just dropped by to check on little Sarah.
Glad you could make it, Doctor. We heard a lot of hubbub on the street earlier.
Solomon began leading Morelli back toward the stairs.
Yes, it was all rather strange. Some man, someone I've never heard of, tried to gun down Father Clayton and myself from that alley over by Milter's church. A U.S. Marshal came from out of nowhere and shot him before he could shoot us. All very odd, very odd. And rather sad, too.
It's a day for odd things, my friend.
Oh, is that Sarah?
It is indeed.
Solomon waited for the stupefied Morelli to catch up to him, and then pointed to Rachel, who was sitting in their rocking chair trying to calm the infant.
Hello. I'm thinking she's better.
Back at the marshal's office, Abe and Rafe had just left to go have a drink or two at the saloon and catch up on old times when Salmon Kendall came through the door.
Jason, I believe we've solved our water problem.
What water problem?
Oh, come on. You remember last summer, don't you?
Jason did indeed. The whole town had suffered for weeks when both the creek and the well had run dry. They lost livestock and nearly lost some citizens, too, before a wagon train came through and saved their overly ripe carcasses.
So, what's your solution?
We're going to build a water tower.
Salmon, we don't have the money, wood, or labor to build a water tower.
That's why we need to use your office.
You're going to turn my office into a water tower?
No. We're going to have a meeting to pick the men who'll go up into the Bradshaws to cut down and mill the wood. We've got plenty of tar, don't we? And more on the way?
Well, there's always more on the way.
Don't go thinking I've got bats crowding into my belfry, Jason. We know what we're doing.
And so Jason came to be thrown out of his office on that morning while he watched the town elders slowly file in. He turned on his heel and crossed the street, headed for the saloon.
You're the jokers who made me marshal. Might as well have a drink with Abe and Rafe. I deserve one after what I've been through this morning.
Please, Doctor, say again that you aren't fooling with us.
No, Rachel, I'm not fooling. I don't understand why, but she seems much improved from yesterday. We're not out of the woods yet, but I think we have a good chance of making it.
Rachel scooped the squalling infant up from the table where Morelli had been examining her and hugged her to her breast.
Thank you, Doctor. And you should pardon me, but thanks should be to God as well. Sarah, oh, my little Sarah, praise Jehovah for your life. Praise Him for all good things.
Slowly, with a huge grin on her face, she sank down into the rocking chair. Solomon shook Morelli's hand until he thought it might drop off.
Okay, easy there, Solomon.
Solomon let his hand go free.
Oh, sorry, Doctor.
Your wife's right. You shouldn't be thanking an old country doctor. You should be sending your thanks to God. He's the only explanation for this. I've never seen anything like it in my life. Well, I'll stop by tomorrow to see how she's coming along, all right?
Morelli left the mercantile, walking a little taller.
Thank you, Lord. Thank you for watching, for paying attention, and for hearkening to their words. Amen and amen.
He went, not toward his home and his office, but out to the wagon train once more. While he walked down the line of wagons, his thoughts turned to poor Frank Solomonk, the man who had been hit by a saguaro arm before the wagons came to Fury. His wounds had been complicated by his wife's failure to get out all the spines, although he couldn't blame her. Most of what was left peppering the man's back was invisible to the eye and had to be felt for.
I don't suppose a screaming husband was the best patient either.
He screeched when Morelli did it too, but Morelli hoped to get the last of them out today. If he didn't, Frank Solomonk would die. When he got there, Frank was dozing fitfully in the back of the wagon, and his missus, who'd said, "Call me Eliza," was off to the side, tending to a fire which looked like it had just been kindled.
Frank? Frank, are you awake?
He knew Frank was conscious. He didn't like surprising people, especially patients on their deathbeds. Frank lifted his head and cranked it around.
Yeah. Morning, Doc.
Morelli squatted beside Frank. He hadn't seen their children. Perhaps their mother had sent them off to play.
How you feeling, Frank?
Frank just made a face. Morelli could see why. Frank's back was an angry red and purple thing, almost a monster apart from the rest of him, and as septic as anything Morelli had ever seen, aside from some amputees during the war. Some amputees who had later died. He smelled of death, too. Not a good sign.
All right, Frank. I'm going to try to dig out the last few spines today. And then we're going to see if we can't clean up some of the pus, all right?
Salmon Kendall had just closed the meeting of the town elders. The other men, having heard and in some cases whispered about the Cohen's sick newborn, were leery of setting foot in a house of sorrow, and all agreed. Salmon would have to tell Solomon about the council's decision.
Solomon, the baby's better?
Solomon's arms were held wide as if to engulf the entire town, or possibly the entire world. Salmon couldn't be sure, but he backed up a step. Solomon didn't seem to notice.
My friend Salmon, she is much improved. The doctor was here and said she has a good chance now, but I know better. God will not allow her to die. She is beyond harm, a blessed child.
And you know this because...
Because I know, that is why.
The council just held a meeting. Sorry we didn't call for you, but things have been pretty rough up here and...
You didn't wish to bother me?
Exactly. Anyway, we're going ahead with the water tower. I've got volunteers to go up north into the Bradshaws to get the wood, and I'll start making a list today of men to do the building and the tarring of it.
It will have to be very strong indeed if we have another storm like we had the other night. Can we make it that solid? And where did you decide to put it?
Yes, it'll be strong, Solomon. We have plans to use reinforced crossbars on the legs and tie-downs, and I believe the weight of the water will hold it in place.
God willing.
Exactly. And you know that empty lot a couple doors down from the marshal's office? The plan is to put it in there. It's centrally located so that everybody will have equal access to the water.
No one owns this lot?
Not a soul. Like most of Fury, it's a land grab.
And the council members agree to all of this?
Salmon nodded.
So be it, then.
Drink to it?
So be it.
He and Salmon marched over to the drawer where he kept a decanter of red wine and also a whiskey bottle. He picked up the latter and held it out. Salmon grinned. Solomon poured out two whiskeys.
To all good things which come from God.
Imagine the fellows who go up to get the wood will have a little problem with that. You know, thinking it'll all come from courage and muscle and dumb luck. And later they'll attribute it to wisdom and foresight and a staggering knowledge of lumbering skills. Perspective's funny that way. But I'll drink to the Lord's help, by God. May he bless this endeavor.
L'chaim.